Good evening and welcome to tonight's teleconference brought to you by the West Region of the National MS Society. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question and answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, press 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. Once your question is asked, your line will be remuted. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. At the end of this 60-minute teleconference, we will conduct a brief three-question survey over the phone. After the survey, you may end your line or stay on for an optional 15 minutes for further Q&A with the speaker. I would now like to turn the conference over to Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Program for the National MS Society Greater Northwest Chapter. You may begin.
Thanks a lot, and thanks everyone so much for registering for our regional teleconference. We're really excited to have you all join us tonight. This teleconference is one of the many free and helpful programs and services available to people living with MS through the National MS Society. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you're a person living with MS, a friend, or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867. Before we begin the teleconference this evening, I'd like to introduce you to Sue Dolan, Walk MS team captain for Sue's crew in Washington State. And Sue would like to share a few words with you about how Walk MS has impacted her life and how you too can get involved in this inspiring event. Go ahead, Sue.
Thanks, Piper. I've had a lot of fun with annual Walk MS events for, probably over 20 years now. Every chapter has a walk, and some actually have more than one location. I found that friendships are made at these events. Those of us with this disease can see that we are not alone. Our families, when they're with us, can see that our support network is much bigger than just them. But I think that the real reason I keep at this event is that I feel that I'm really helping the ones that financially support my efforts in this event to better understand this disease, and by doing that, they dig deeper into their pockets and make these events the biggest fundraisers for research, programs like this one and many others, and then also services for those of us with MS and our families. So join us at a Walk MS event.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Sue. And
Thanks,
for tonight's Heather. Teleconference, we'll discuss aging and MS. And we're very pleased to be joined by Dr. James Bowen, neurologist and medical director of the MS Center at Swedish Neuroscience Institute. Dr. Bowen's research interests include a variety of aspects of MS research, including clinical trials of new treatments. He's also involved as a peer and ad hoc reviewer for numerous publications and has authored more than 200 articles, abstracts, and publications relating to MS and other neurological diseases. So I'd like to thank everyone again for being on the call and like to hand it off to Dr. Bowen. You may begin, Dr. Bowen.
Thanks, Piper. Tonight we'll be discussing issues about aging and MS, and this is going to be in three sections of about 15 to 20 minutes each. So the first one is going to be about issues with aging and MS in general. The second segment will be how the aging process affects multiple sclerosis. And then the third will be about how MS affects aging. So after each of these three segments, we'll have about 5 minutes for questions. And then at the end of the whole talk, I'll stay on the line for 15 minutes or so and ask or answer any questions that people might have. So the first section is just some general issues about aging and MS. And the first one I thought I would discuss is what age do people get MS? We think of MS as having its peak age of onset somewhere between 20 and 50 years of age. But it turns out that the tails on that curve are quite broad. So for example, I've seen at least half a dozen children who got MS when they were in the five-year-old range. The youngest that I've heard of that got MS was about 18 months old. So you can get MS well below the age of 20. On the other end of this curve, similarly, you can get MS for the first time when you're much older than 50 years old. And my personal oldest patient was 76 years old when they had their first MS attack. But the record that I know about is one patient in her mid-80s that got her first MS attack. So details on this can be very broad. And just because a person has their first symptoms beyond the age of 50 does not mean that they don't have MS. So there's really no age that a person is completely free of risk of having MS. The next thing that I might mention is how the course of MS changes over time. It's for many patients, it starts out as relapsing, remitting disease. And this means that patients have discrete attacks where something will go wrong neurologically. Usually this reaches its worst over just a few days, usually 2 or 3 days, and then it slowly improves. It may improve all the way back to baseline, but more commonly it improves almost to baseline, so maybe they're left with, say, 5% loss on that particular attack. With each subsequent attack, they can lose a little more ground, and over the course of time, they can accumulate disability as a result. With time, oftentimes this pattern changes, however, and they get fewer and fewer attacks over the years. And then they reach a time when the baseline is no longer stable in between attacks. So the worsening of their disability, rather than occurring through a series of stair steps downward, like you would get with relapses, it's really more of just a slow worsening that slowly becomes noticeable over a period of months. And this is called secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. So this change from relapsing, remitting over to secondary progressive, about 60, that's 60, percent of people that start with relapsing multiple sclerosis would shift over to secondary progressive. And this would occur generally about 10 or 15 years after they are diagnosed. The course of MS as one gets into older years of their life is quite variable, and it's difficult to predict. Oftentimes, patients have fewer attacks because, in general, patients with MS have fewer attacks over time, but especially as they get older than 60 or so, most patients would have fewer attacks, but they often don't stop completely. So there's likely no one period of time that they're completely off the hook from MS and the danger of additional attacks. So another issue is prognosis of MS, and of course this is very difficult to give a prognosis on because the disease is quite variable, and everybody has their own unique set of symptoms and a unique time course for that. In general, the prognosis for survival with MS is better than most people, I think, initially would guess. There was a study done back in the 1980s, and it was done in London, Ontario, in Canada, and they followed over 1,000 patients up to 30 years and looked at what the outcomes with these patients were. And, of course, there was a lot of variability in how people did, but it turns out that only 5% of people had died from their MS 30 years after diagnosis. So this is not when they are 30 years old, but it's 30 years after they were diagnosed. So if the average person was diagnosed at around age 30 or so, this means that most of these people were in their 60s or 70s even. So the risk of actually dying from MS is not that great. In fact, The lifespan of most patients with MS is normal. There are a few patients that have bad disease that might die earlier, and those pull the average down for all the other MS patients when you're looking at the average across all these people. But the majority of MS patients would live a normal lifespan. I might also comment on what people with MS die from. And generally, they don't really die of MS directly. Rather, what they would die from is an infection. And the two most common infections would be pneumonia or bladder infections. The problem with bladder infections is that patients may not be aware that they have a bladder infection because they may not feel it as well because they would have numbness down there. They might get a bladder infection bad enough that the bacteria would be able to spread from there into their bloodstream. And when that happens, it's called sepsis. And it can be quite dangerous and is a common way for people with MS to die. This can be minimized by being aware of bladder issues with MS, but also taking fevers seriously because this may be a sign that the patient has a bladder infection that they're not otherwise aware of. The other infection that people commonly might occasionally die from in MS is pneumonia. And generally, this would happen only in patients that had severe disability, such that their muscles that were involved in breathing were also affected by it. Then if they get a pneumonia, they might not have enough strength in those muscles to cough sufficiently to clear the pneumonia. The best way to prevent that, of course, is to get your flu shot so that you don't get the flu. But also, some patients do breathing exercises for those who have visited a hospital. This would be those little plastic things that have those balls in them that you can practice either sucking or blowing air to push the ball up the tube and exercise your lungs that way. So for patients with severe disabilities, these are good things to do to improve their lung health. So actually, the issue with MS is not so commonly dying from MS. It's disability. And again, the prognosis for that is highly variable. The same study done in Canada showed that by about 20 years after diagnosis, that there was around 25% or so of people that were bad enough that they needed a wheelchair. Turned out that only about 15% of patients did not have any limitation of their walking. So the majority of people were having trouble walking, but not so much that they were in a wheelchair. Now, having quoted all of those statistics from this study, I want to emphasize that this study was done in the day before we had any treatments for MS. So all of these medications that we now have to slow down MS happened after that study was done. There really has not been a comparable study in modern times with the medicines. So we believe that the prognosis for MS is better, and in fact, considerably better than the odds that I just mentioned. Another issue with aging is whether MS stops just because a patient has gotten older. And I mentioned many times that MS is quite variable, and it's the same as people get older. Some patients have a decrease in disease activity so that they just don't have attacks anymore, but others continue having attacks throughout their lifespan. So a lot of doctors recommend just continuing to treat patients even when they get into advanced years, because we don't want to risk the patient having an attack that they might otherwise be able to avoid. Some people prefer to stop the medicines as they get into advanced age and just see what happens. If they have attacks, then they could go back on the medicines. Of course, the risk of that approach is that if you have an attack that causes some degree of disability, then it's too late. You already had that attack. You could have otherwise avoided the disability that resulted from it. The good news, though, is that the disability that might result from a single attack is usually not that much. Rather, the problem with MS is that you have many attacks over time, and each contributing a little bit of disability can cause, they can add up to causing more severe levels of disability. So one attack is usually not such a huge risk. The last thing that I wanted to cover in this section is whether the treatments for MS seem to work in people that are older. All of the drugs that have been tested in MS have had really good studies done on them that have demonstrated that they are effective really in three areas. They decrease the number of MS attacks that people have. They decrease the disability that accumulates as a result. And then they've looked at MRI and found that all these drugs decrease MRI activity of the disease. However, these studies are done generally in people that are 55 years old or younger. And the reason for this is that on these studies, any bad outcome that might happen has to be reported to the FDA as an adverse event associated with the drug. And they want to enroll patients that are reasonably healthy so that if there is an adverse event, you can be fairly confident that it's related to the drug itself rather than just due to aging. So, for example, if you we know that heart attacks are more common as you get older, and if you enrolled a lot of people with advanced age, you might have an increase in heart attacks that showed up in your study. So they do the study in younger people and assume that it works in older people. So none of our treatments have been studied in people as they got older, but we assume that they continue to work because the patients that we have had on these drugs, some of them have been on drug for up to 20 years now, and we know that there's no bad effects of being on the drugs that long. So for that reason, most of the time we keep treating patients even as they get older. So that concludes my comments on this first section. The next two sections we'll talk about how aging affects MS, and the next one how MS affects aging. But I wanted to turn it back over to our operator at this point to see if anybody had any questions about the material that I just covered.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. There's a question from Barbara. Please go ahead.
Most of the drugs that you're discussing aren't they for the relapsing remitting. It's not for, like, secondary progressive, because as I understand, there's no medication for that particular phase of MS.
Yes, that's correct. And it's much faster and cheaper to study it in relapsing cases because it takes about a third the number of patients to enter the study as you would have to have for a progressive study. So really all the studies have been done in relapsing patients, and that's what they're approved for. There are some studies now going on in secondary progressive. So, for example, there's a Tysabri study with secondary progressive. And then there are a couple of studies in primary progressive disease. For example, Gilenia has such a study. And then there's a study of a drug that blocks B cells, which is not yet on the market for any other disease that's going on for primary progressive. So we're right on the edge of having some studies done. Hopefully some of these will work, but it's very challenging to do progressive or studies on progressive patients because you can't count attacks and the MRI is not as active. So you're left with just counting disability.
Okay, and there's also a question from Bonnie. Please go ahead.
Yes. I was diagnosed in 2008 with relapsing remitting, although my doctor and I are both sure that I had my first attack in 2002, which means that I've had it for 10 years. I had a lot of damage to my body by the time I was diagnosed, but I've been on Copaxone for 3.5 years, and I haven't had, knock wood, an attack since I've been on it. But I do notice, and, you know, this is a problem I think that a lot of people will understand, is that I'm more fatigued than I used to be. And I don't know if that has anything to do with my MS or just because I'm 10 years older.
That's that's a great comment because MS causes fatigue, and in fact, fatigue is the most common symptom of MS. And we actually don't really know what causes the MS fatigue. It's probably a combination of two things. There's some evidence that it's due to the brain damage itself. So if you have other diseases that cause brain damage, like strokes or trauma or any of those things, they also have fatigue. The other thing that may contribute to the fatigue is the immune system. And I think we all remember how fatigued we were the last time we had the flu and our immune system was revved up fighting the flu. So probably both of those contribute to fatigue. The reason I said your comments were great is because aging also causes fatigue. And MS does not exempt a person from aging issues as well. So it's often pretty hard to tell in patients how much is MS fatigue and how much is aging and all these other factors that can come together. But nevertheless, you can't do much about aging, but you can do things for the MS fatigue. And it's reasonable to treat the MS fatigue in a person, even if you don't know if it's 100% the cause of what their fatigue might be or whether aging is contributing to that.
Okay, doctor. And there are other questions in queue, but I know you had other sections to cover. Did you want to take another question?
Yeah, why don't we do one more?
Okay. There's a question from Sally. Please go ahead.
Yes. First of all, Vonnie said exactly what I think. What is normal as you age when you have MS? You know, and that was a good question. But my main question is what do you consider an aging category? Starting at what age?
Well, being in my mid-50s, I think I started aging at about 20 years old. But it depends on what issue, you know, a person is thinking about, because they're different. Like our mental capacity actually does start declining at about the early 20s. If you look at the rest of our bodies, they generally do pretty well until you reach your mid-50s, and that's why a lot of the research studies cut off enrollment at age 55. But there's not a lot of really major problems with aging until you get up in your 70s for most people. And then, by the time you get to your mid-60s, start hitting 70s, that's when people start complaining about getting a little bit forgetful with names and things like that. So generally around, late 60s and 70s is when you really start having more problems with aging. So I think depending on which area a person is interested in, there'd be a different definition of what aging really is. So with that, let me move on to the next segment of the talk. And this one regards a few comments about how aging would affect the MS. And the first one of these would be about primary progressive MS versus other types of MS. I talked a little bit about secondary progressive MS, where a person starts with relapsing remitting, and then after a time, say 10 or 15 years, they would switch to secondary progressive, where that baseline starts slowly declining in the absence of attacks. But there's this other type of MS called primary progressive MS. And with that type of MS, they never ever have an attack. They just have this slow decline from the beginning. This MS tends to be diagnosed more in later age, often when people are in their 40s and 50s, compared to relapsing, which, as I mentioned, is more like 20 to 50. It also tends to start with spinal cord symptoms, so this is mostly difficulty walking. And because of this, it's been said that primary progressive has a worse prognosis than other forms of MS. However, saying that really is not accurate. The problem in comparing it to relapsing remitting disease is that the starting points are not, you're not starting at the same point with these patients. So with a primary progressive patient, they come to the doctor because they're having trouble walking. So they're already having trouble walking. But the relapsing remitting patient doesn't come to the doctor because they have trouble walking. They came because they had an attack of MS. And that attack could affect, you know, all sorts of things. They could have optic neuritis where it affected their vision. It could affect their walking, but it comes on abruptly. They could have sensory loss, but whatever they had, it occurred with an acute attack that went, that things went badly over a few days, and that brought them to the doctor. The reason this makes a difference is that that attack brings them to the doctor about 15 years earlier than primary progressive MS patients. So if you start the clock at the time that the patient is diagnosed, the primary progressive patient's already more advanced in symptoms at the day that they're diagnosed. But also just the looking at the clock, the relapsing remitting patient got diagnosed about 15 years earlier. So if you actually start the clock at the same time, so for example, start it when patients are all having trouble walking, it turns out that the prognosis is the same for all these different types of MS. So they decline from trouble walking to a cane or to a walker at the same rate, whether they've got relapsing MS or secondary progressive or primary progressive MS. So really, we encourage our patients not to confuse the label that they've been given of whether they're relapsing or primary progressive with prognosis, because the prognosis is really not limited to that label so much. There's also considerable debate about what primary progressive or secondary progressive really is. Do these forms of MS, are they different? And if they are, that would sort of imply that the patient started out with one disease with relapsing remitting, and then after 10 or 15 years, they switched and had a different disease that's now, you know, it has more of a slow worsening. So is it really a completely different cause, or is it the same cause, but it's just shifted? So, for example, we know that relapses of MS have a lot of inflammation that occurs with the immune system attacking the nervous system at that particular location. But it turns out in progressive MS, there's also inflammation. It's just not concentrated into one attack so much, and it's sort of spread more diffusely across the brain. So it may be that one difference in progressive MS and relapsing MS is that it's simply a matter of degree of inflammation and whether it's all concentrated at one spot versus kind of spread out more evenly across the brain. There's another line of thinking that views all MS as progressive from the beginning, but that a lot of this progression is under the radar, so to speak, so patients are not really aware of it until a certain degree of damage occurs. And in that situation, the slow progression would be kind of the heart of the disease, with these acute attacks being more the anomaly of that would occur occasionally when the immune system gets revved up enough to cause an acute attack. So it's very difficult to know what really is the difference in primary progressive and relapsing and secondary forms of MS. There's a lot of research going on now to try to figure out all of these issues. But I think as far as aging goes, that we think of primary progressive especially being a disease that hits people that are diagnosed older. But the main reason for that is that the clock was started later in them because they did not have attacks early on that brought it to medical attention. A few things about how aging affects MS. First of all, not everything that gets worse is MS. And our earlier questioner saying that she didn't know whether fatigue was from the MS or just getting old was right on, that was right on point. Everybody gets aches and pains as they get older. And these aches and pains are usually not directly related to the MS. They may interact with the MS. For example, if a person has trouble walking and they limp, if you limp enough, your back is going to start hurting. However, plenty of normal people's backs start hurting when they get older. So the aging can sort of add on top of the problems that you might get from MS. But a lot of aches and pains are due to aging and arthritis. And it's important to try to figure out whether it is related to tendonitis, arthritis, aging processes like that, or whether the MS is responsible. Another problem that patients note is changes in their vision. And I get this in my clinic a lot. Patients are concerned that they are developing a loss of vision from the MS because they have to hold things farther and farther away in order to see them. Of course, this is not MS. This is just getting older, and everybody has that problem. So as far as vision is concerned, as you get older, you cannot focus close up. And if you can hold something farther away and it comes into focus, well, you're just getting older, and it's not necessarily the MS. You can test this out just going to the eye doctor, and they put you on that machine with all those little lenses that they they click in front of your eyes. And if they can correct your vision, that means that it's a lens problem due to aging usually, and that can often be corrected with glasses. The concern we have with MS is not the one that the patient can correct their vision with lenses. It's the patient you cannot correct with vision, because if it's a neurologic problem, just changing the glasses, the shape of the lens and the glasses is not going to fix that. So in general, vision changes that you can correct with glasses are not related to MS or due to aging, and especially if it's that thing where you need longer arms because you can't hold it far enough away from you in order to see. Another aspect of aging, of course, is cognitive loss. Cognitive loss is quite common with MS as well. And then, of course, it's common with aging, and then we all worry about Alzheimer's disease. And these can be somewhat difficult to tell apart. It's quite normal for people to have some minor forgetfulness, and It's nearly universal as people get older, especially when they start getting into their 60s and older, that they have trouble remembering people's names. So when people tell me they're having trouble with names, that doesn't really put up any, send off any warning bells for me, because it's quite common. And most people, if they talk to their friends, will find that their friends are having similar problems as well. The other things that are common with aging, just normal aging, is, you know, going into a room and forgetting what you went in there for, or forgetting where you put something. The car keys seem to be a common thing that people forget where they put them down. So those kind of things are not as concerning. The difference between MS cognitive problems and Alzheimer's disease is, you know, that's more problematic, I think. The cognitive changes from Alzheimer's disease are due to the loss of brain cells. So each of your nerve cells in your brain, that's where the information is stored for a memory. If you have a cell that remembers what your birth date is, that cell, you know, holds that information. If that cell dies, then you just lost your birth date. So with Alzheimer's disease, that information content proper is lost. So people forget facts like that. The problem with MS is different. So the nerve cells, for the most part, are retained, but what is missing is the insulation on those nerves. So, so the information is still in there, but because the insulation is damaged, the signals are conducted slow. So it ends up where you just can't move information around in your brain fast enough. So these people don't forget their birthday. They just may not be able to access it very quickly. And then they can't do things like multitask, which requires manipulating a lot of information quickly. So those tend to be more MS cognitive changes. Occasionally, there'll be a patient that is very hard to just figure this all out. And in those cases, we can send them to a neuropsychologist who's able to do testing on the memory. And usually with that sort of testing, we can figure out whether the person is having Alzheimer's disease or whether it's MS or none of the above. Another issue that is common as people get older is bladder issues. And, of course, with men, they get prostate problems, and that usually manifests itself by you need to go to the bathroom and you run in there, and then you can't get the stream started. So you run in there and nothing happens for a while. And that can also happen with MS, the same symptom. The other in women, they tend to get leakage, and you can, of course, get that with MS as well. You can get urgency where you got to go and you got to go right this second. And women can get that as well due to aging because the muscles that hold the bladder closed get lax with aging, and especially after childbirth and aging. So they can sometimes be difficult to tell apart. But one major clue is that especially for women, if a person is coughing or sneezing and has leakage, that's usually not MS. That is just a pressure problem. When you cough, you put more pressure and the muscles just aren't strong enough to keep the bladder closed, so you get some leakage. So oftentimes that is more a sign of aging. In some patients, though, we have to do testing on their bladder to see which of these issues is really causing their symptoms. The last thing I'd like to cover in this section is about menopause and MS. And there really is no fixed relationship between menopause and MS. Some women, the MS cools off after menopause and it's less active, but other women, the symptoms continue on as if nothing had changed. So each person you have to evaluate separately, because they all have their own different pattern. There is a question about what role female hormones have in MS. And the answer to that is still unknown as well. There are some, well, women that get pregnant do better while they're pregnant. And then as soon as they deliver, then they have more attacks. So they break even over the 9 months of pregnancy and then about 3 months after delivery. But the fact that they did better during pregnancy has led some people to wonder whether estrogens might actually benefit MS. There are some animal studies on both sides of this argument, pro and con, whether it helps or not. There are some early studies in humans that have determined that it's at least safe from an MS standpoint to take estrogen replacements, and this would presumably apply to menopause as well if women need to take hormones for menopause. But so far, we don't know definitively whether it actually helps with the MS or not. So with that, I'll stop again, and we'll turn it back over to our operator to see if anyone has questions about this segment.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Kenneth or Kenneth, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have two questions. One, I'm 54. I was diagnosed at 50, but I noticed a couple of years I've been walking with a walker, and every time I go shopping and push the shopping cart, I always fall a couple of times. Like, what is this?
Well, there are many reasons a person with MS might fall. And one of them is that they're just simply too weak to hold themselves up, you know, for their legs to hold them up. Another is that their coordination is just bad. So, you know, some MS patients walk like they're drunk, and, of course, they can fall down when that happens. Not that they're drunk, but that the neurologic signals are incorrect, so it makes them look that way. Another problem is that people can get numbness in their feet. So you can't feel where the floor is, or if you're on uneven ground, you can't feel that uneven ground. And then, of course, if you get a little leg weakness on top of that and you end up catching your toe or something, then you end up tripping, and then you can't right yourself because your legs aren't working properly. So there are many contributors to patients falling down with MS. And, you know, using things like a shopping cart are a good idea. That's I have a lot of patients that do that in the grocery store because it's kind of a walker for them. Others, you know, if they fall down enough, they use the scooter that are in the grocery stores and some of the hardware stores, and, they, you know, that'll prevent falls as well. But many different reasons why an MS patient would fall down.
Okay, there's also a question from Helen. Please go ahead.
Hi, I would like to know, I had heard earlier in, I have been diagnosed at 60, but through the years we've figured out that I probably have had the MS for at least 25 years. But when I was young, there was a gal that was diagnosed, and they had told her at that time she had been on birth control too long. Well, I remember that I've been on birth control too long, and I've also been on estrogen too long, because when they did the hysterectomy, every time we were going to go off, they said no, because I would probably spiral. Things in my life had happened. So now my question is, being on birth control and then being on estrogen later in life, too long on both of those, would that have been a contributing factor to the MS?
So it's felt that estrogens do not have a negative effect on the MS. And in fact, the studies to see if it helps MS use estradiol, which is one of the estrogens, and one of the common estrogens in birth control pills are also the pills they would give women for menopause. So it's likely that loss of estrogen would not be responsible for someone having MS, or would not be responsible for making MS worse. You know, sort of another issue is that the you could take estrogens. The risk of the estrogens not related to MS is that there's a slight increase in strokes on estrogens. So if a person had strokes, of course, that would be bad for MS. But even though the risk is increased with estrogens, the total risk of strokes is quite low, even in people with estrogens. So that really wouldn't contribute as well. So it's unlikely that these estrogens are the explanation, and it's probably just that you had MS, and this is the natural course that MS takes.
Okay, doctor, and did you want to take another question, or are you ready to move on to your next section?
Oh, why don't we do one more?
Okay. The question is from Linda. Please go ahead. Linda, your line is open. Please go ahead with your question.
Are you talking to Brenda?
Oh, okay, sorry. Maybe it was typed in wrong, but yes, ma'am, that's you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I sustained a lot of head trauma as a young person, and I probably, you know, looking back as everybody with MS does, I probably was symptomatic with MS in my mid-20s maybe, but it was just like a bike wreck here, kind of a, you know, a stumble there. I never really could put my finger on it. Is there any way, if I sustained MS as a result of head trauma, I worry about as I get older the effects on me, but also could I have passed it on to one of my children?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, a big concern of mine, obviously.
Right. Well, there's kind of several issues there. One is the we don't think that trauma causes MS, and they've looked at trauma in several studies, and it does not seem to cause the MS, so you're probably okay in that regard. However, trauma can cause brain damage, and if you add that brain damage to MS brain damage, you end up with, you know, double the damage. So so the two, even though they're separate problems, actually can add together because they affect the, you know, both affect the brain and can cause problems in that regard. The last part of your question about the risk of passing this on to children, MS is more common in women. It's about 3/4 female and 1/4 men. And so the risk of passing it down to a kid depends on their gender. So a daughter would have about a 4-5% chance of getting MS, and a son would have about a 1% chance of getting MS. So the risk of this, that's higher than the general population, but it's not really huge. You know, to put it in perspective, if a parent has early heart disease, the risk is more like 17% that their children would have heart disease. So it's less inherited than something like that. So for the most part, children can get MS if their parent has it, but the risk for each child is not all that great. So for the last segment, I thought I would talk about some about how MS affects some of the issues of aging. And we sort of touched on this to some degree earlier in the talk. One is that as you get older, there are certain disabilities associated with aging, and of course the MS can add to that. So as we get older, our nervous system gets some wear and tear on it. This can affect the nerve signals and can lead to, you know, some neurologic dysfunction. One of these, our earlier questioner asking about falling down, one of these relates to that, and that's that the nerves that go down to the legs is quite common in advanced age to have numbness in your feet from that as well. So if the MS adds on top of that age-related numbness, then you could have more trouble walking. Similarly, changes in the balance center, as you get older, your equilibrium is not as good, and MS can add on top of that. Also, changes with eyes can occur, and I already mentioned that you might need to hold things farther away as you get older because of farsightedness. Other things to consider, though, are that if you change glasses, that actually changes, as the lens gets stronger, it changes the magnification of things, so they don't look the same size. And when you put your foot down, the ground may not be where it used to be. Many years ago, I heard a routine by Bill Cosby, the comedian, who was talking about getting bifocals for the first time and then trying to get out of a car and how the curb was way up here, and then when his eyes popped into the other lens, the curve is way down there. And that sort of thing can really mess with people with MS and make it difficult for them to walk as smooth as they used to. So the MS can add on top of these aging processes and really cause people difficulty. Another issue that can happen, of course, is relationship changes with aging. And each stage of life has its own stressors, and people have to adjust to these. And it's not always easy for a couple to adjust to this sort of thing. Some of the big changes are things like retirement. And, you know, there's some people that retire that don't have a plan, and their plan is to sit on the couch and watch TV. And then you have the spouse within that couple who is used to the other one going off to work every day, and now suddenly they're underfoot 24/7, and that can kind of grate on people. So these sort of life changes are something that people really need to think about, because they can cause changes, and people have to work through that. Other relationship changes are related to disability and caregiving. And, you know, again, these things have to be worked through with a couple. It's nice if a couple has talked about these, and certainly people that have MS, it would be wise for them to think about this ahead of time and discuss what they would like to minimize the burden on their caregiver of what kind of care do they want, and you know, how they would like to be taken care of as they get older, and then especially if they get older with disability. We touched on the cognitive changes earlier, and you know, again, we all get a little forgetful, but with MS you get these this additional difficulty with processing speed that has to be accounted for. And oftentimes what is important for many of these people to do is to simplify their lives so that they're not trying to multitask so much. This only gives them one thing at a time to think about rather than having 10 things come at them all at once. So anything people can do to simplify their lives, unload their brain. If you're spending a lot of time trying to figure out what your calendar is, then maybe you should start writing the calendar down or keep it in a smartphone, for example. Some people spend a lot of their brain power trying to remember when to take their medicine. So if you just program that into a programmable timer or else a smartphone or something like that, that can also unload people. Things like using automatic deposit on bank accounts so you don't have to constantly be trying to figure out if you paid the bills this month can really lessen the burden on people. So anything like that that can be done is helpful. And also just uncluttering the environment people live in. So if they can simplify the junk lying around the house so that they have an easier time sorting through the mail of the day because there's only one pile of mail that came in that day and not all these piles of stuff, that can really help people keep focused as well. Also in uncluttering, this involves not only physical clutter, but other clutter. So having the TV blasting in the background while you're trying to think about something, or things like that can really use up a lot of brain power. So turning off all these distractions can really help people cognitively function better. A few other issues are effects on employment. And a good number of MS patients are not employed. And the two most common causes that patients leave the workforce is for cognitive reasons or for fatigue. There are a number of things that can be done to try to maintain employment with accommodations. Sometimes it can be as simple as moving a person's office so they're nearer to the bathroom, or getting them a keyboard that works better with their hands, things like that. But for cognitive changes, it's often difficult to make these workplace accommodations. The loss of employment is a big deal for a lot of people, not only financially, but emotionally, and especially if there's a couple involved, because then it changes the whole dynamics of the couple as well. Working through the disability process can be quite painful. There's a huge amount of paperwork, and it's difficult to get through this, and they turn down about 85% of people on the first go-round. So people have to be persistent, make appeals, and really get their ducks lined up. For example, if a person's claiming that they're unemployable because they have cognitive impairment, Social Security disability is not going to just take your word for it that you're cognitively impaired. It's likely that you would need to get testing on your memory to prove that you really do have cognitive impairment. And it's important that that testing be done by someone who knows MS cognitive testing, because if they do the same test as Alzheimer's disease, you will often have an MS patient looking normal on that test, because that is not the problem with MS. Shifting from employment to unemployment can be quite traumatic for people. Finally, just a few comments about Medicare. So once a person, hits 65 or so, they are eligible for Medicare. And if they go out on disability earlier than that, they get Medicaid for 2 years, which does not pay for drugs. And then after that 2 years, then they roll on to Medicare. So we have a number of people who are on Medicare, either through aging or because they became disabled earlier and then rolled onto Medicare at an earlier age. Medicare in general has actually fairly good coverage for drugs for MS, but they're administered through separate companies. And certainly in Washington State, where I am, there's at least 30 companies that administer Medicare programs. So each one has their own formulary, and before you just sign up for one of these Medicare products, you need to make sure that the drugs that you're on are covered by that particular insurance broker. So you can call them, but there are resources, and the multiple sclerosis chapter in your local area can direct you to these resources. In Washington State, there's a thing called SHIBA, which is a group that will take your drugs and run it through a computer program. So they'll tell you which of these many different insurance products would actually cover the drugs that you were on, or which one would have the best match for your drugs. So it's important that you don't just blindly sign up for one of these things. You need to make sure that it really does cover the drugs that you are using. So with that, I will wrap it up and answer about 5 minutes of questions, and then we will have some time at the end for 15 minutes or so questions. So I'll turn it back to our operator.
Pardon me, Doctor. I show that we've reached our 60-minute mark. If we can go ahead and do our polling survey questions now, and then we'll have our Q&A session after.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this begins our polling session. Our first question: this teleconference provided me with the new and helpful information for understanding how aging affects MS. Again, this teleconference provided me with the new and helpful information for understanding how aging affects MS. Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. I'm sorry, 2 for somewhat, 3, no, 4, not sure. Again, press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, 4 for not sure. The poll is now closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare our next question. Next question. I am motivated to act on the suggestions and feedback I received from this call. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, 4 not applicable. Again, I am provided to act on the suggestions and feedback I received from this call. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 no, 4 not applicable. The poll is now closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare our next question. This is our final survey question. Overall, I was satisfied with this teleconference program. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, or 4 not applicable. Again, overall, I was satisfied with this teleconference program. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, and D, not applicable. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our polling questions. Ladies and gentlemen, if there's any questions that you have, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Our next question is from Lindsay. Lindsay, go ahead.
Yes, I assume that's me. I'm trying to figure out. I'm 60 years old. I had my first symptoms in 1975. I feel that I've totally leveled out over the last 10 years. Is this something that, is that practical, or am I fooling myself?
Well, it's actually some people do notice that they level out, and some don't. They did a study that was published about a year and a half ago at one of the MS meetings. This study was out of Gothenburg, Sweden, and they followed people that had had MS a long time, and they looked at what happened to the ones that had been fairly stable, and they were 45, they started them around 45 years after they diagnosed, and they followed them another decade, and it turns out that a large number of them went on and had worsening of their MS, even though they were that far out. So some people are stable, but there's enough of them that continue to have worsening that, that it can be a concern. The big difficulty is to know whether to treat people with medicines to slow down the disease-modifying therapy drugs, as they get much older. And So some people continue these drugs because if a person has been on them and they're doing well, that may very well be the reason that they're doing well is because of the medicine. And if you stop it, they could get worse. I think we all have a few people that were diagnosed back in the days before any of these medicines were available. And if they have been stable for many years and not on these medicines, well, then we tend to follow them off the medicine. But if they're on the medicine and doing well, we tend to keep them on it.
Our next question is from Debbie. Debbie, go ahead. Debbie, your line is live. Please go ahead with your question.
This is for Debbie Lynn.
Yeah, that's you.
Oh, yes. Hello. I was diagnosed in 93, and ever since I've been diagnosed, I've been trying to go to many seminars, and I've noticed that the males who have been diagnosed within a couple years, they went from being able to being walking to actually being in the wheelchair and being divorced. I mean, everything around their life has changed significantly. So I don't know, is there a difference between the male and the females with the MS? And that's what I wanted to know.
Well, males get MS less often, so only about a quarter of MS patients are male. But it, when they get it, it tends to hit their spinal cord more than the women. And, of course, the spinal cord is where the signals are heading down to your the rest of your body. So men tend to have more problems walking, and as a result, you know, that, of course, is disabling. So it can be, you know, a more difficult disease in men, mainly because the location of where the MS hits them hardest is a bad location. So, yeah, your observation that men get it harder is accurate. Having said that, though, it's still quite variable in men, and I have, you know, plenty of men that are quite advanced in age and still doing well, and of course we have some that aren't. And you know, we have men that continue to have careers. I have several professional athletes as patients and things like that. So again, you have to take it on a case by case basis.
Our next question is from Teresa. Teresa, go ahead.
Hi. Could you comment on over 30 years ago, I was diagnosed with MS, and it used to be for muscle pain and nerve pain, I would take, you know, like Tylenol with codeine, and now after 30 years, I'm taking it every single day. Could you just comment on that?
Well, pain is quite common in MS, but it's not always due to the MS. It can be directly due to the MS, but a lot of the pain is due to tendinitis and also muscle tightness and things like that. Also, as you get older with MS, you, of course, everybody can get arthritis, but if you're walking funny, it may put more strain, say, on your hips or your knees, so you can get more arthritis contributing to the pain. So it's a pretty common symptom to have pain, and the aging process can just add on top of that. It's important to figure out what the cause of the pain is, because if it's arthritis or tendinitis or things like that, then oftentimes physical kind of treatments like a lot of stretching and range of motion exercises may do better than medicines. And then if the pain is due to the MS itself, so that the nerve signals are messed up and that's what's contributing to the pain, then there are medicines that are sort of more specific for nerve-type pain. There's quite a number of them. And then some people do end up on narcotics, like you mentioned. So I think the first step is to try to figure out what the pain is due to, because it may not be directly due to the MS. And then kind of select a treatment within that, that you know, to treat that specific cause.
Our next question is from Bonnie. Bonnie, go ahead.
Yeah, I found it really interesting that you mentioned that people stopping working, not being able to work. A lot of that was due to cognitive issues. I had a situation where when I first started getting my exacerbations, I was falling, but I've been a klutz all my life. I mean, I've managed to break almost every bone in my body just walking. So it really didn't click with me at the time that there was something wrong. But I finished my master's program when I was 43, and I had a 3.9 GPA. And halfway through my doctorate, I was about to start on my doctoral dissertation. I couldn't keep up with the work suddenly. And I was turned down for disability, Social Security disability, twice, because it was very hard to prove that I had such cognitive impairment. And they finally did send me to a neuropsychologist who agreed with me that my brain was truly scrambled. And I just found it really interesting because I always assumed it was just me that had that problem. I was not aware that so many other people had it as well, because I knew people, you know, 30 years ago, and neurologists used to say there were no cognitive problems having to do with MS. And now, you know, what you're saying is really opposite to that.
Right. And yeah, I actually have old textbooks that say that MS doesn't affect cognition. And I think they were written by doctors that never actually saw any real patients. They just sat around writing stuff. Because anybody that's been in an MS clinic very quickly picks up that there can be cognitive problems. But I think the reason that it is so commonly overlooked is that it is not like Alzheimer's disease. So the information content is there. They're just slow processing it. Even a psychologist that does testing on memory may not know about this. So we had, an example of a person not too long ago that got tested, and they were struggling in their job, and they went to they're applying for disability, and Social Security demanded testing on their memory, but they used the lowest bidder for the person to give that test. So they sent them to somebody who doesn't know MS, and they came back with an IQ of 150. So they said there's no problem. Well, then, of course, they were turned down for their disability, but then they came and saw us, and we said, no, you got to see a specialist in MS cognition to get your testing. And they turned out to be fifth percentile in how fast they could process information. So I think doing the correct test to demonstrate is key. And then what you said about getting turned down twice with Social Security is absolutely true. You have to get all your ducks lined up before you make that application, and you have to have very good documentation of what the disability is, because if you just say I've got cognitive impairment, but you don't have it with really solid testing on your cognition, they will turn that down.
Our final question is from Benjamin. Benjamin, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I wondered if you could comment on the drug that's soon to be released, BG12.
Right. There are BG12 was due to be evaluated by the FDA at the end of this month, but a couple of weeks ago, and actually it's about 4 weeks ago now, they delayed it by 3 months. So it's now going to be the end of March. We are still waiting to see exactly what the FDA is going to say about this drug, but it's widely believed that they will approve it. We will have to see what the final safety information from the FDA is, but so far the preliminary information that we have is that it looks to be quite safe. It is oral, It's one pill twice a day, and it doesn't really have serious side effects that I'm aware of yet. We'll see if the FDA knows anything that the rest of us don't. It does have a couple of side effects that patients might want to know about, and one of these is about 20% of people get diarrhea. That tends to be limited to about a month or so for most people. And then about 30% get flushed when they take it. If anybody has experience with niacin for cholesterol problems, it's similar to the flush for niacin. That also tends to run its course over a couple of months or so. And then it seems that aspirin, taking an aspirin a day, seems to minimize that flush. So those are the two main side effects. And again, we should hear by the end of March, and knowing the FDA, it will be right at the end of March when we hear about that. And then it'll probably come on market shortly after that, because the company has had plenty of time to work with the FDA about how to distribute the drug and things like that.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may all disconnect.